It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up with President Biden highlighting his economic agenda in Wisconsin yesterday, we'll check out partisan claims made about the economy and find out what matters most when it comes to your financial future. First, after the U.S. Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade with the Dobbs decision over the summer, groups opposed to abortion have shifted their focus to medication abortions and abortion pills. The court ruling left it up to states to decide their own laws on abortion access, but these pills can cross state lines and create complicated questions about jurisdiction. A federal judge in Texas is currently reviewing a lawsuit seeking to revoke the FDA's approval of one of the most common drugs used for abortion, mifepristone, that would remove it from the market even in states where abortion is legal. According to data from the Guttmacher Institute, abortion providers reported over 50% of all abortions used those medications in 2020, even before Roe was overturned. A ruling on that federal lawsuit is expected in the next week. Maybe as soon as tomorrow, it could have a widespread impact on abortion access. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about these abortion pills and the laws that surround them? Do you think that they should be unapproved by the FDA? Do you want to see the court ban them, or do you think it should be left to the states, or do you want to see them legal across the board? And how should they be administered? A lot of questions there, too. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel Rebouchet is the James E. Beasley Professor of Law and Dean of the Beasley School of Law at Temple University. She's a leading scholar in reproductive health law and family law. She recently published a paper called The New Abortion Battleground that was cited by the Supreme Court. Rachel, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you for having me.
Pre-Dobbs, what was the state of legal regulation of these of mifepristone and other abortion other medications used in abortions?
So medication abortion, which is two drugs, before Dobbs was regulated like other abortion services, whether it be surgical or aspiration abortion. States generally didn't treat medication abortion differently, although a few states did target medication abortion by trying to require that a physician be in person to hand it out, to require ultrasound, to require other ways in which the abortion service was carried out. But medication abortion, like other types of abortion, is really different in two ways. It's only approved by the FDA, the Federal Food and Drug Administration, through 10 weeks of pregnancy. And it's pills. So it's mifepristone, the drug you mentioned that the FDA regulates closely, and misoprostol, a second drug that you take after mifepristone. And it's before Dobbs and before the more recent FDA changes to the law, it had not been taken up by as many people as one would have thought medication abortion would have been suited for. But that's really changing.
Can you talk about those new FDA changes you just mentioned?
Sure. So the FDA, before Dobbs was decided during the pandemic, lifted a restriction on mifepristone, that first drug in a medication abortion, which essentially required people to pick it up at a healthcare facility. A clinic, a hospital, right? During the pandemic, the FDA was sued to lift that restriction because it was thought that requiring people to go to pick up a drug that they can take at home without any provider supervision increased patient-provider contact and increased the risk of contracting COVID-19. A court suspended it after, you know, a series of steps. The FDA decided on the basis of evidence that actually people didn't need to go to a clinic to pick up the pills. Why that's important is because before that rule change, you couldn't go to a pharmacy to pick up abortion pills. You couldn't have them mailed to you. Lifting the in-person requirement has allowed online clinics to deliver medication abortion services and mail the pills to people at their homes or at any location of their choosing, so long as it's legal to do so. So what's really changing is the means by which people can receive medication abortion.
Now, here's Dobbs. And now states are in charge of this. and things get complicated. Can you talk about the range of laws as they apply to these pills now?
So the, what's now complicated is before Dobbs, states couldn't ban abortion, including medication abortion, if it was before the pregnancy was viable. Now states can, and about a third of the country bans abortion from the earliest stages of pregnancy, which includes abortion pills. So you have really a map that looks pretty stark for prohibition or permission. Other states, by and large, allow medication abortion subject to some restrictions. And so you have a really a map of the United States that where characterized mostly in the Midwest, in the South and Midwest, abortion's not permitted at all. And now on the coast and in various states, abortion through different stages of pregnancy, that is permitted. What we see happening is that people, even in states where abortion is banned now, are still ordering abortion pills online, not through those virtual clinics that I mentioned, but through other services that exist outside the United States. We also know that people are able to navigate the internet, mail forwarding, in a way that also lets them have access to mifepristone and misoprostol, even if they are living in a state that bans it.
We're talking to Rachel Rabouchet with the Temple University Law School, looking at abortion pills, lawsuits challenging the availability of the medications, and more. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Rachel, that brings us to this legal challenge in Texas right now, looking to effectively say FDA unapproved this medication. What's going on? What's at stake?
So this is a lawsuit taken by the Alliance for Hippocratic Medicine. It's a group that does not support abortion. And they sued to argue that the FDA, when it approved mifepristone to end pregnancies in 2000, 22 years ago, acted outside of the agency's authority, that the FDA misapplied its statutory authority, and for that reason, with some other reasons, the court in Texas should take mifepristone off the national market. It should essentially say the FDA was wrong then, it should be removed now. The Biden administration, through the DOJ, has countered that the drug was approved over 22 years ago. That's a long time for a drug to be approved, and then for it to claim that it was approved incorrectly. That in fact, the FDA didn't rush to approve mifepristone. It took years. They denied the application a couple of times before, and that this had all been investigated over the course of the last two decades. The reason people are watching this case is because it was filed and will be heard by a court that has a pretty strong track record of delivering opinions that are hostile to abortion rights. And so there's a lot of speculation that potentially even tomorrow, when the decision may come out, that mifepristone could face a national injunction, which means it'd be off the market, even for states that still have abortion as legal.
We're talking to Temple University Law Professor Rachel Rabouchet about abortion pills and efforts to restrict them by state laws, by a federal lawsuit. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the legal status, the use of these abortion pills? Do you think they should be removed from the market? Abortion under Wisconsin's 1849 law is effectively illegal, except in very rare instances. Do you think that there should be efforts to stop the use of these pills, the mailing of these pills or driving of these pills into Wisconsin? What could that look like? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Rachel Rabuchet, law professor and dean at Temple University, with us today to look at anti-abortion groups' new focus on abortion pills and some of the legal challenges ahead. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Rachel, for a state where abortion is legal and where lawmakers want to make sure that abortion pills aren't coming into their state, what kind of enforcement and surveillance efforts are we starting to see to try to do that?
I think you see some states like South Carolina proposing bills that would ban information on how to receive pills online, how to order them, or how to use a mail forwarding for ordering pills, having them shipped and then forwarded to you in another state. I think we're seeing some criminal investigation, people who are self-managing their abortions, ordering pills online, and then having complications arriving at ERs, and then having states not use abortion laws to charge them, but other laws like fetal assault or the like. I think that we'll see states start to, you know, search people's digital footprint to see if they are trying to procure abortion pills online. And I don't think that these are going to be easy policies to enforce. I think that they could very potentially incite a lot of backlash from the public, which it's clear assumes by and large that their health data and their private information should stay that private.
If it were to be ruled or unapproved by court order, as in this case in Texas, then what? These drugs are out there. They're on store shelves right now, or you know, pharmacy shelves, I should say, not right out in the open. What then?
And yeah, and I should have added that one of the things the FDA did is also permit pharmacies to seek certification to dispense mifepristone where it's legal. No, pharmacies haven't done that yet,
right? Thank
except
you.
For an online pharmacy, which mails pills, Honeybee Health. But yeah, there is a nationwide injunction, a couple of things. The FDA could reinstate its safety restrictions, its rules could reinstate mifepristone on the market, but that's going to take time. So there will be a gap between this injunction taking force and the FDA acting. Providers might start using the second drug only in a medication abortion. It is possible to terminate a pregnancy with just the second drug, misoprostol. You might see a change in clinical practice. I think you would absolutely see an uptick in the number of people ordering mifepristone and misoprostol online from other countries, going across the border to bring the drugs back into the country. You know, I think it might stop the sale of mifepristone through the manufacturers, but it's not going to stop people from seeking out abortion pills.
Joe from Eau Claire called, couldn't stay on the line. He said he thinks there needs to be better access to these abortion pills. The laws need to be relaxed, Joe says. And that reminds me, Rachel, you write in one of the pieces I mentioned that some states are trying to take action to provide access to these pills. What are we seeing in those states?
So there are seven states that have passed laws in anticipation that their providers who are providing abortions that are legal in state will be attacked from out of state. A state like, I guess, most recently Illinois won't allow its providers to be sued in its state courts or subject to criminal discipline or professional discipline. A state like Massachusetts is trying to protect providers who are providing telehealth services for abortion by saying that their protection applies regardless of where the patient is. These have been called shield laws, and they anticipate the coming reality where states try to apply their abortion laws outside of their borders. There's good reason to think that those policies or those attempts have constitutional problems. We have a right to travel in this country. We protect interstate commerce. But those haven't been tested out in courts, and courts could disagree about whether or not Texas, for instance, can create a private cause of action to sue anybody who helps a Texan leave Texas to seek an abortion in another state where abortion is legal.
A lot of moving parts here, Rachel. What do you have your eye on most closely when it determines the future of the law as it applies to these abortion-related medications?
It's a great question. I think I've been thinking a lot with a couple of great co-authors, David Cohen and Greer Donnelly, about the FDA's role here. There are two lawsuits that have been filed that do the opposite of the litigation we were just talking about in Texas, that claim that the FDA, because it regulates medication abortion so closely, should trump state laws that contradict FDA policy. And if courts were to agree, that would create a medication abortion-sized hole in abortion bans for that state, potentially across the nation. And that, I think, is an interesting strategy that's also not been tested, but it also suggests another avenue by which medication abortion could become more accessible. The FDA could continue to remove the other restrictions that are on mifepristone, which would increase its availability in states where it's legal, but probably ultimately nationwide.
And briefly, as we wrap up, if this court, this federal court in Texas, does in fact unauthorize mifepristone, would you expect to see appeals to that ruling?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that what we have ahead is just more litigation. The majority opinion in Dobbs made the argument that Roe v. Wade needed to be overturned because it was unworkable. And that's a way of saying that created tests and opinions, decisions that had inconsistent results that were hard to apply. But we're seeing not a more workable set of laws now, and that the legal landscape is really defined by this interstate conflict and this litigation over what states can and cannot do, what the federal government can and cannot do.
Rachel, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Rachel Rabouchet, the James E. Beasley Professor of Law and Dean of the Beasley School of Law at Temple University. She's with us today to talk about the legal status of abortion pills and the pushback against them from abortion critics. Like the rest of the country, since about 2010, Wisconsin has seen a slew of major retail closures. But as Joe Schultz reports, local communities are getting creative in finding new uses for those former malls and big box stores.
PicklePro Courts on Madison's north side is packed as people participate in a pickleball tournament. The indoor facility features multiple courts, each contained with netting. It's open 24/7 to members. But the site wasn't always a bustling athletic space. In fact, it spent most of its life as a vacant former grocery store in Madison's Northside Town Center strip mall.
It was literally vacant space for 20 years.
That's Patrick Reha, the owner of PicklePro Courts, which opened last August. Reha worked to convert the deserted store into a state-of-the-art pickleball facility.
We had to put in all new electrical, all new plumbing, all new flooring, all new lighting, and so everything was required new, but we ended up with a great facility that people love.
The retail industry has seen thousands of closures since 2010. The Great Recession was especially hard on retail. And then, as the national economy began to recover, Amazon and other online retailers continued to cut into brick-and-mortar sales. In 2017 alone, the U.S. saw more than 7,000 retail stores close. And industry analysts predict another 30 to 80,000 could close in the next 2 years. That's created a lot of empty buildings in a lot of Wisconsin communities. Recently, though, many of Wisconsin's former retail spaces have found new life. A portion of Green Bay's East Town Mall is now a manufacturing facility for American Tent. And that's not the only community that's revitalized a former retail facility. At Mineshaft in Oshkosh, arcade games were to life as patrons blast alien invaders and race in Mario Kart. This site was once a Walmart, but when the retailer moved to a bigger location across the highway, Its old property became a blight on the community. It was razed in 2007. In the late 2010s, mineshaft owner Tom Masters and other developers worked with the city to revitalize the decaying retail plaza. They built a large, rustic brick and wooden building in place of the old Walmart. After opening the mineshaft in 2020, Masters plans to grow the restaurant's game room, add another dining room, and build an outdoor dining space.
I would say that hopefully in this next year or two that we would be expanded.
In the same former strip mall as mineshaft, a former JCPenney has also been converted into Extreme Customs, a company that sells custom rims and tires. Rob Clayman is with the Oshkosh Chamber of Commerce. He says revitalizing those properties was important.
Having this great redevelopment there, as people enter Oshkosh, it just kind of transforms the image that we have when you're coming into the community.
While there are still plenty of vacant big box stores across Wisconsin, these projects show that former retail locations can be transformed into economic assets to their local communities. In Janesville, leaders hope to turn a former Sears into an indoor sports complex that could have an annual economic impact of $23 million. The Woodman Sports and Convention Center would host conferences and youth sports tournaments, with a year-round ice rink and an area that could be used for indoor soccer or basketball. Jennifer Petrozillo with the City of Janesville says the project aims to boost local tourism.
It really allows us to diversify our economic drivers and expand into the sports tourism market.
Today, that property is still just an abandoned Sears, but Janesville officials hope the Sports and Convention Center can open in fall 2024. Joe Schultz, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up after the news, following President Biden's stop in DeForest yesterday, we talked to a Wisconsin economist about the economic agendas of both parties and how they affect our employment prospects, inflation, and more. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, it can be tough to have good conversations about difficult topics like race, gender, and identity, but it can be done. Get some advice with the authors of the new book, Say the Right Thing. Now, after Tuesday night's State of the Union address, President Biden stopped in Wisconsin yesterday. He talked to a crowd of Democratic Party officials, donors, and dozens of union members at a worker training center in DeForest. The president's message was focused on the economy, workers, and the middle class.
Through the American Rescue Plan, we're funding workforce development programs, including $128 million here in Wisconsin, dollars in Wisconsin, so American workers are prepared to compete in the economy we're building. This is a blue-collar blueprint to rebuild America.
In her response to the president's State of the Union address, Arkansas Governor Sarah Huckabee Sanders painted a different picture of the American economy.
In the radical left's America, Washington taxes you and lights your hard-earned money on fire. But you get crushed with high gas prices, empty grocery shelves, and our children are taught to hate one another.
Our next guest is here to help us better understand the competing claims about the economy as well as the fiscal policies that could make a difference in our personal finances. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How does the economy look to you? What factors matter to your family's budget? What's your job situation like, your prospects right now? We've seen low unemployment numbers. Is that changing your work or the workers you try to hire? How is inflation affecting you? Are you seeing the impact? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Menzie Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Menzie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back, Rob.
Well, I want to look at the president looking at the jobs numbers and his critics looking at inflation numbers. Let's start with jobs, some pretty big numbers and low numbers when it comes to unemployment. What is the latest you're looking at on the employment scene, Menzie?
Well, I think the latest numbers were certainly very surprising. You know, 517,000 jobs is big, you know, by any standards, much in excess, something like three times what economists had been expecting. And that's already on top of a market that looked like it was bubbling along pretty well, very tight, with even the previous estimates of job growth were moved upwards in a big revision that occurs once a year. So on jobs, we seem to have an economy that's moving along very well, perhaps in some ways so well that some people on Wall Street and so forth are afraid that the Federal Reserve might say, well, this is a sign of an overheated economy. On the other hand, average wage increases didn't show up as being particularly fast. So to the extent that wage increases feed into inflation, we might have some hope there. And maybe we shouldn't be expecting as much inflation. That's the current state of debate, at least on jobs.
Now, if I'm a president, and that probably won't happen, but if I am the president and job numbers look good like that, I'm going to try to take credit. Can you connect the dots between White House policies and or things that Democrats in Congress and the president passed that could be contributing to our current state of affairs when it comes to jobs?
Well, that's an excellent question. I mean, it's a tenuous link between any given policy that the White House can implement on its own and what happens to the macroeconomy. And then there are always these lags that confuse people's ability to detect the linkages. I would say, however, you know, in the past 2 years, the president and the Congress have passed this set of bills, the bipartisan infrastructure bill, the Inflation Reduction Act. Those things, particularly the bipartisan infrastructure bill, I mean, they're pumping money into the economy of a sort that's probably less inflationary, more measured over time than some of the other measures that have passed. And so some of that spending certainly hasn't started, but the mere anticipation that some of those funds are coming along probably helps support optimism. And to the extent that you've got a pretty stable fiscal policy so far, that is, the president and the Congress aren't fighting interminably over which way to raise taxes, lower taxes, or over a debt ceiling so far, that stability has added to, I think, people's willingness, firms' willingness to hire and invest.
Yesterday, the president, speaking at that training center for the Laborers International Union in North America in DeForest, made a point of highlighting organized labor in particular.
For the first time in a long time, we're building an economy from the bottom up and the middle out. The bottom up and the middle out. With products made in America, with union labor. Not labor, union labor.
Okay, so the president yesterday pointing toward, I think, manufacturing to an extent and manufacturing job increases that would benefit organized labor in particular. Are you seeing that happening?
Well, I think it's clear that the president has implemented a set of policies that are in some ways trying to support manufacturing. Certainly the bipartisan infrastructure bill is putting funds into activities, construction, and so forth that are blue collar. The Inflation Reduction Act has all these tax credits and rebates and so forth that will probably give incentives to greater investment, which will employ workers. Hopefully a whole bunch of them will be middle class and unionized. Other policies include the continuation of some tariffs, the tariffs that were placed on Chinese goods, for instance, and on aluminum and steel. There's a debate whether that is actually supportive on net of all union jobs. It certainly probably helps narrowly defined steel and aluminum worker jobs, which are unionized, but might have a negative impact on the rest of the economy in terms of employment. So certainly you've got that. You've got the sort of verbal support for unions. I think the gains in terms of union leverage, in terms of workers' leverage, has been largely due to the fact that we've got this very tight labor market. I don't want to minimize the effect of the president's support, but if I were to try to detect how the bargaining has shifted between labor and companies, I think a lot of it has exactly to do with the fact that there's a tight labor market and supply is less than it used to be, and demand is high.
Talking to UW-Madison economist Menzie Chin about the latest on the U.S. jobs picture, inflation, and more, and political claims for credit or blame. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question about the state of the U.S. economy, the Wisconsin economy? What would you want the government to focus on, if anything, that you think would boost the economy? What do you need? What would help you? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. In response to the president's visit, we heard the chairman of the Wisconsin Republican Party, Brian Schimming, put out a statement yesterday. Here's an excerpt. Quote, Wisconsin households and businesses have faced crushing inflation, decreasing real wages, and increasing energy bills for months. And trying to buy votes with his inflationary spending and Green New Deal agenda isn't the answer to helping Wisconsin families. Menzie, let's turn to the inflation side of things now. We saw inflation, I think, peak over the last year or so, highest level since, what, the early 1980s or so. What is the latest on our measures of inflation now?
Well, you know, what's true is year on year, inflation was 6.4% over, 2022. But that's kind of looking backwards. Over much shorter time span, let's say 3 months, what you can see is inflation is decelerating quite rapidly. And as a consequence, what we have is the forecasts are something like 3% inflation for 2023. So I think what we can say is for sure inflation is, for the moment, decelerating.
Now, if I'm the party not in the White House and I see high inflation, I'm, of course, going to want to try to connect the dots, saying that guy's policies are what's causing a lot of this inflation. Are there things you see, again, from the White House and from bills passed by Democrats in Congress over the last couple of years that may have, at least in part, contributed to the higher inflation levels?
Definitely some of the responses in the past have added to or contributed to the inflation we're seeing now. I mean, it's important to recall the context. You know, we closed down the economy in 2020 for several months, 2 months to be, shortened up in the statistics. And that, what did that do? That reduced demand, but it also reallocated demand to goods. We reopened the economy, but people were still wary of going out and being in public and going to restaurants and so forth. So what did that do in turn? That meant that we had disproportionate spending on goods and a limited supply and capacity to bring in goods from the rest of the world. So, the confluence of those two things, it means that you had this burst of inflation. We sort of like hit the wall in terms of what we could supply in goods. And that demand was in part supported by funds in both the packages passed under the Trump administration and then the act passed under the Biden administration in the first few months. So surely those things added something to the demand, so the pressure. But don't forget, we had all this congestion in the ports and infrastructure log jams. We had the shortage of semiconductor chips, and we had the resurgence of oil prices, which then were redoubled when the invasion of Ukraine was expanded. So between the two, what we have is a set of both supply and demand factors, only part of which is directly attributable to the activities of or the proposals of the administration.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Pat is with us in Green Bay. Hi, Pat.
Good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, it's actually twofold. Number one, when are the politicians going to stop their silly bickering back and forth? It's this group's fault. It's that group's fault. When are they going to start doing what they're supposed to be doing and working for us? And then the other thing, please, these people that sit there and they chirp about the high price of fuel and everything else, but when you look at the corporate earnings, they're in the billions of dollars.
Pat, thanks for the call. Let's go to that second point. Benzie, I don't know if you're going to solve the partisan divide here for the first part, but Corporate profits, Pat, and others are saying, well, wait a minute, we're paying a lot of inflation, but we're seeing from oil companies, I think in particular, some big numbers when it comes to their annual revenue and profits.
Well, absolutely. Each time there's a surge in oil prices, then you see temporarily, at least, that the oil companies make sort of essentially windfall profits. Their profits jump up a lot, essentially because, you know, they've already invested and sunk expenditures in. Suddenly they find great demand for their product, and the demand is inelastic. That is, it's not very responsive to prices. And so in order to have, you know, the supply being matched up with the quantity demanded, the price adjusts a lot, and boom, you get lots of big profits for the oil companies. Now, if I'm talking about inflation, inflation is not just high prices; it's the continuation of prices rising over time. And so, there, you know, part of that is just, you know, supply and demand having an impact. So, you know, as long as even if we didn't have the oil companies, you know, raising prices tremendously, they would still be raising prices as there was scarcity. And so the concern is that, you know, there's these underlying forces that are pushing up prices and hence inflation.
Pat, thanks for that call. Menzi Chin is with us, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, with us to look at the claims politicians make about the economy and help us follow the economic indicators that matter. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. How is the economy treating you these days? Have you seen a public policy that you think helped or hurt you in some way at your in your line of work, in your daily shopping? Call in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your experiences, your solutions, or your questions. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk now with Menzi Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison, looking at the president's visit to Wisconsin yesterday, the various claims that political leaders are making about the state of our economy. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Tom is with us in Oshkosh. Hi, Tom.
Hi. My question is, with the low unemployment rate, how does that correlate to the very unreported labor participation rate, and how does the labor participation rate today compare to 5 years ago and maybe 15 or 20 years ago?
Tom, thanks for the call. Great question, Menzi. The labor participation or workforce participation rate, a measure that Tom says we don't often see in the headlines.
Well, that's an excellent point. I mean, you have to understand that the unemployment rate is a function of, you know, you're looking at how many people categorize themselves in it to the extent that the statisticians are happy with as being unemployed, as divided by the labor force, where the labor force is, you know, the people who are employed plus defined as actively searching for a job. And that has certain requirements of you having applied for several number of jobs. So that calculation of the labor force might not necessarily take into account discouraged workers or the workers who have dropped out of the labor force for, let's say, health reasons. And I think that is one of the factors that people have been looking at over the past year or so in tracking the evolution of the labor market. So, yes, the unemployment rate is quite low, but we're probably missing out on some other aspects. And the caller's right, the labor force participation rate is down. And I think some of it has been attributed to, among other things, more people have retired than you would have expected ordinarily in the past year and a half or so. And then there's some evidence that illness, and here we might say the longstanding illnesses that are associated with COVID, have taken a lot of people out of the labor force. So the labor market is tight, partly because of the, you know, the enhanced demand that we have from some of the stimulus packages and recovery packages of the past. But some of it is also the fact that, you know, some people have decided to exit the labor market because they're either ill or they just, it's not worth it. I'm close enough to retirement, too hard to find a new job in this new reconfigured economy.
Tom, thanks for that call. Rich joins us now in Delavan. Rich, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. Thank you very much for taking my call, and I really love what you're doing with your show. Just a comment about government spending. You know, we have a problem getting both parties to agree on a $3 trillion relief bill for infrastructure work that this company or country desperately needs. But when we were overseas in Iraq and Afghanistan, spending billions upon trillions of dollars, that was basically a carte blanche, and nobody ever complained about that. And as a former service member who did two tours in Iraq, you know, it's kind of disgusting to see that the amount of money that was spent over there, and we can't even get politicians to agree on, you know, actually improving this country from a financial perspective.
Rich, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate that. Menzie, it's an interesting point, distinguishing between the impact on inflation and the future economy between, you know, big investments in military spending for a war in Iraq or Afghanistan versus maybe the same amount of money going into infrastructure development in the United States. Can you talk about that a little?
Oh, yes, sure. I think that's an excellent point to be brought up. And I'll just mention, first of all, we did pass a bipartisan infrastructure bill. And that was actually to the amount of $1.2 trillion. Now, $1.2 trillion over the course of 5 years. So it's not every year that you're getting that amount. But that's a substantial package. And I think that was something that many, many, many economists of all stripes could get behind, because we know that first, infrastructure investment has a big multiplier. For each dollar you put into infrastructure spending, you get probably a in total is something like a $1.6 increase in GDP, which so that number is like a lot bigger than, say, for spending on consumption otherwise, let's say civil servants. Now, to the fact that about defense spending versus infrastructure investment, I'm 100% behind that. I mean, you know, if you're spending on tanks and you're spending on building fortresses or camps in overseas, that's not going to directly enhance your GDP or your productive capacity in the future. It shows up in GDP, but it won't show up in, you know, how many widgets you can build next year. Whereas if I'm investing in infrastructure, you're going to be able to move things around more quickly. People will get cleaner water. If you're investing in broadband, more people can access the internet. And, you know, if you've ever have to fought to get a good internet connection, you can imagine what gains you could get in productivity once we are connected effectively. So I would say, yes, I mean, that's what people have been saying for a long time. We need more infrastructure investment. And that's one of the achievements of the past couple of years. And, you know, if somebody had asked me beforehand whether it would have gotten done, I would have been dubious, but it did get, get done. There are other investments that are being undertaken, and it's harder to figure out what the returns will be. So we have the Inflation Reduction Act, which is like $400 to $800 billion worth of tax credits. And, you know, we're hopeful that spurs some investment in green technologies. I'm not aware of, you know, any definitive studies of what the multiplier is for that. And we also have the CHIPS package, which is, I believe it's like $280 billion worth of investment in semiconductor chip factories. And we'll have to wait and see, you know, whether those investments pan out. They sound like good ideas, and they probably will have positive benefits for the economy, but it's harder to define how big they'll be.
Thanks a lot for that call. And Menzie, we'll leave it there. Thanks, as always, for joining us today.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
That's Menzie Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He joined us this afternoon with a look at the partisan divide over economic policy and the effect those policies have on us and our economy in general. We take some big picture looks at the economy like that. I love them. Is there something on your mind when it comes to our economy, big or small? Something you've always been curious about? Something that you think affects your life that you don't hear talked about much in the media? We'd love to hear from you, and maybe that'll set up a future conversation here on Central Time. You can always email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Let us know what you want to hear us talking about when it comes to Wisconsin's economy, the American economy, and beyond. ideas@wpr.org. coming up tomorrow. On The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, learn how to take care of your muscles and your bones. It's the latest installment of health advice and science in ongoing Body Week on The Morning Show. If you missed some of the earlier discussions, some brain science along the way, heart health and gut health, find them in our archives at WPR.org and then join the muscle and bone conversation. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8. Check it out here on the Ideas Network or at WPR.org.